From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made on your credit card statement. If you have credit card debt, you probably handle some of the bills online. And I'm wondering if you've noticed the options that the credit card company gives you when it comes to making your next payment. I have. My first option, the automatic option, is to pay the minimum. That's the default. Smarter people than me have explained that this is called the anchoring effect, and it turns out that credit card companies and lenders have spent years making sure Americans are just not very good at making financial decisions. Instead of helping people pay off their cards in full and spend as little as necessary, credit card companies do the opposite. Americans are the marks, the suckers, and there are hundreds of billions of dollars that come from this setup. Author Michael Lewis, you know him, the guy who wrote Moneyball and The Big Short, he's got a podcast, really good podcast, and on a recent episode, he welcomed a man who has tried to flip the whole setup around and actually help Americans make good decisions. That man is Jason Brown, and his company is called Tally. And when I heard the episode, I wondered, why doesn't everybody know about this? Why isn't this the norm? Brown asks us to, for example, think about our credit cards. What color is your credit card? Is it a fun color? Maybe there's a picture of your dog on it. You probably get points for spending, rewards of some sort, maybe air miles. They encourage you to have fun, spend more, pay the minimum, pile up debt. And then they can hammer you with 19 to 30% interest. There are $34 billion in overdraft fees last year, more than $100 billion in credit card late payment fees and interest charges. Average American credit card debt's around $15,000. The average American's got debt across three different cards at least. And Michael Lewis says it's understandable if people are skeptical about yet another personal finance app. Lewis said on his podcast, quote, Americans have been screwed by consumer finance for so long that they were likely to be wary when some company sprung up claiming to be on the consumer side, end quote. But Jason Brown is actually doing that. He's the real deal. And we wanted to spend the hour with a guy trying to fight what has been a losing fight for so long. Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally, is with us. Jason, welcome to the program. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
I'm going to be so disappointed if you turn out to be a fraud, by the way, because I really believe in you.
That's what Michael Lewis said.
I know. I loved that episode, and listeners, we'll link you to it if you want to check out the podcast, the Against the Rules podcast with Michael Lewis, featuring Jason Brown and Tally. How did he find you, by the way?
You know, it was kind of funny. I ended up sitting next to him at a lunch, and we just got carried away chatting, and just we both share a passion for, you know, protecting consumers from this insanely complex and predatory financial system. And he happens to live, I live in San Francisco, he lives in Berkeley. And so we got together for lunch a couple months later, and he told me about his podcast, and he pitched me on the idea of, you know, doing an episode, and I obviously couldn't say no.
Well, the Nobel Prize winning economist Richard Thaler, who I know you know pretty well, he told Michael Lewis, quote, I've tried unsuccessfully to get someone to create what I call the good bank. It would warn you when you're about to overdraw your credit card rather than wait until the end of the day when you've swiped five more times and they've charged you a $25 penalty for each swipe, for example, end quote. That's Richard Thaler. Are you that good bank? Is that what you've done here?
That is what we're building. And it's actually funny. I was just hanging out with Richard Thaler on Monday over, he was in Berkeley as well. And so we were hanging out, and he's actually doing a rewrite of his book, Nudge. And he's updating it. And he's doing a chapter on what he calls sludge, which is when financial institutions and predatory establishments use nudges for evil. And, So we have built an experience that is using both technology and nudges for good. So Tally, we're a consumer tech company, and we're trying to automate people's financial lives so that we can really manage things for them and kind of turn the tables on the financial institutions themselves.
We're going to get back to what you're doing in just a moment here, and when we do that, I want to address a really important question that. I think I came away from the podcast feeling like maybe this was missing, and some of our listeners in the run-up to this program have already indicated that they feel like what we're missing here is personal responsibility, that if you get a credit card or if you take out student loans, that's your fault. That you're the one who is taking on this responsibility. You got to be accountable. It's not somebody else's fault that the interest rates are high, and that's on you. We're going to get back to that theme coming up here in just a moment. But before we even get there, I want to kind of explore your personal story, which in many ways it seems to have set you up to not only be what you're doing, to be doing what you're doing, but also why you believe what you believe. And that's your relationship with your mother. So tell me about your mother and why you told Michael Lewis that she's your hero.
Yeah, well, so growing up, I mean, first off, my mom is just has the biggest heart, and there's just an immense amount of love in our home. But the financial stress and anxiety was always present. And my mom actually, you know, she came from a pretty under-resourced childhood herself, and she ended up, you know, building her own small business that she's run for 25 years. She actually homeschooled my brother and I, and we both were able to build on that academic foundation and go to good colleges. And she's unbelievably disciplined. So, you know, what I observed is, despite being so hardworking and so disciplined and so smart, she hasn't really been able to achieve any of her own financial goals. And what I realized is, you know, if you look at the ultra wealthy, they have a team of ultra smart people, probably in Connecticut or New York somewhere, that are doing all their financial thinking and work for them. And I was like, man, if my mom had had that, I think she would have been in a totally different financial spot. And, you know, just reflecting on where we are in history, we're at a point where it is possible to build into software what currently requires a team of, you know, people with masters and PhDs. We can build that into software, and we can give that to everybody so that everybody can have this software-based, you know, advisor or advocate that can help us make the right choices and really, you know, kind of interface with the outside financial institutions and, you know, make us less stressed and better off financially.
When you talked to Michael Lewis, you talked about the lessons you learned watching your mom try to manage money. I grew up, and you and I were born in the same year, we're the same age. I grew up in a bit of a different circumstance. I grew up, you know, my father was comfortable. My mom never really had much. My mom was the kind of mom who, you know, she would try to give you $5 or $10 when you know she really didn't have it, and she'd kind of sneak it to you. And then when she wasn't when she wasn't looking, I would try to sneak it back in her wallet or her purse, because I knew she didn't really have it to give. And you grew up with a mom who, you know, you set out those envelopes and that was the money to pay the bills in the envelopes. And once that money was gone, it was gone. Describe a little bit more of what that was like for you to see that.
Yeah. So my mom would, and just to elaborate a little bit, She didn't make much money, but what she had was all in cash, and she really liked being able to touch it. So she had, I think it was 5 or 6 envelopes for all the different things. So like utilities, rent, food, ties, things like that. And she would just, you know, when the money was out of the envelope, then, you know, we wouldn't be able to, you know, buy any more of that. So oftentimes I would check, and, you know, the grocery envelope would be, you know, getting down to the single dollars or totally empty. And, you know, my mom would somehow, you know, make do, and she would dig deep into the pantry, and, you know, we never went hungry. But that anxiety is, you know, I saw the toll it took on my mom, and, you know, I even felt that as a child. And, you know, it's interesting. We did a study that looked at, you know, people with credit card debt and found that, you know, people have actually medical levels of anxiety just from having card debt. And obviously that's only one small piece of the entire puzzle of people's financial lives that can create anxiety. But, you know, that anxiety can lead to, you know, feeling like pressure on your chest or grinding your teeth at night. And it's just it's something that I think is really sad that people have to live with.
I want to get back to your research. I find the research so interesting on this, because some of it's intuitive, but some of it's not. I think there are some surprises there. When you think about the way people talk about personal responsibility with money, some people will say, well, you know, you just got to make good decisions. Or if you're in debt, you know, you probably made bad decisions. your mom and your family, you really stretched food, didn't you? I mean, it wasn't a case of, well, you're spending money on the most expensive items in the grocery store. You guys got pretty good at stretching food, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was all a part of my mom, but very, very much so.
So when it comes to now, the idea of what does drive the emotions of debt and money, you wanted to really understand this, and I know you spent some time and you paid for some research. What did you expect to find about what drives people's anxiety or their concerns or their fears about money, their emotions about money, or their behaviors? What did you expect to find, and what did you actually find?
Well, you know, specifically when it comes to car debt, I expected to hear a lot of people expressing regret. Like, I think that there's this kind of meme or this stereotype we have in our heads that, you know, the people who have credit card debt, you know, they went to Vegas or, you know, they bought a vacation they couldn't afford and, you know, they're just irresponsible. And, you know, certainly those moments do happen. So I thought there'd be a lot of regret. But the reality is it's actually anxiety that people feel. And so regret is grounded in the sadness emotion. Whereas anxiety is actually grounded in the fear emotion, like the sense that there's this threat in my life and I just don't know how to protect myself. And so that that really surprised me. And when we started just talking to hundreds of people in credit card debt, you find out that the majority of people with credit card debt end up that way over time, and it's just like one little mishap followed by another. You know, it's like their car breaks down and they don't have quite enough money to get it fixed, so they just pay for it on the card. Or oftentimes you'll see people graduate from college, and if they don't have a safety net from their parents, you know, that 6 months to 12 month transition from college to trying to, you know, find a job, find a place to live, then you need some clothes to do the job you got hired for, there's oftentimes this significant shortfall of funds. And that ends up going on the credit card, and it kind of just builds up over time. And, you know, some, you know, people will wake up with $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 of credit card debt. So I think it's dangerous to not have empathy for the lived experiences of folks. And that's something that I've definitely seen among some groups of people, maybe that they kind of take for granted that their parents helped bridge their cash flow when they were graduated from college to that first job, and they don't recognize the fact that there's actually a lot of people that just don't have that. So anyway, it's empathy is actually one of our core values at Tally. And it's what we use the word change shoes often, but it's just like, you know, taking a step back and really imagining what it'd be like to be in that situation.
Literally millions of Americans with that much anxiety, and the anxiety from credit card debt and the fear of what that means can manifest physically in the same way that people who have, you know, heart disease and other stuff, right? I mean, it actually impacts physical health, doesn't it?
It's a huge toll on physical health. And it's, you know, I mean, it literally, when we talk to folks about, you know, what it's like to have credit card debt, it's, they use metaphors like, you know, I feel like I'm drowning, weight on chest, like I can't breathe, or, you know, like literally like teeth grinding is really, really a common thing to have happen, which leads to all these other knock-on medical effects. So we're a mission-driven company, and our mission is actually to make people less stressed and better off financially. And when we started the company, you know, I was really focused on, you know, we're here to make people better off financially. And, you know, we still stand for that. But what I didn't realize is that the true cost of all this, the most expensive cost, is that emotional toll. And that's why we actually updated our mission to focus first on making people less stressed. And then obviously as a nice cherry on top, also better off financially.
Talking to Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally. What's the website, by the way? People can check you out, Jason.
Yeah, you just go to meettally.com, meettally.com, or you can just type Tally into the App Store, either Google or Android, and you'll find the app there.
I invited Jason on the program after I listened to him talk to Michael Lewis on Michael's podcast, Against the Rules, and it was an eye-opening conversation for me to hear about what Jason's doing, and frankly, to ask why there was even an opening for Tally, why there isn't even an opening for Jason to be doing this, why the system is the way it is. Well, Jason, right on cue, Jim emails me to say, Evan, I have an I have an idea. If you don't want anxiety, don't take out debt. Don't take out student loans. Don't sign up for the car you can't afford. Don't buy the house you can't afford. No anxiety. Okay, that's what I'm talking about, emails like that. And I understand Jim's point, Jason. I'll let you respond to that directly, and then we're going to kind of get into how you see even human evolution and the way companies are trying to exploit the way people sort of naturally are. But what would you say to Jim and those like Jim who say, oh, well, you don't want the anxiety, don't take out the debt?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think let's just even talk about student debt, right? So you're, you know, a 16, 17-year-old kid, you know, everybody says you got to go to college. You want to get ahead in this world, you got to get to college. And you're like, how am I going to pay for it? They say, don't worry, you're going to get loans, it'll be fine. And you apply, you get into a school, and you go to, you know, the guidance counselor, the financial aid office, and they're like, yeah, just sign these papers, it'll all be fine. I just think assuming that people can know the true cost of that, it's just not actually possible to be able to run the calculus of what's my lifetime earnings with and without a college degree and with and without debt. So that's just one example where it's actually just not possible for people to do that calculus. And I think this current generation is now looking with a lot of skepticism on, is it going to be worth it for me to go to either college or that kind of college? So obviously it's a complicated issue. And then specifically when it comes to credit cards, so literally if you do not have credit cards in this country, then it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get a good credit score. About two-thirds of your credit score, so most people have heard of FICO, two-thirds of your FICO score is actually dependent on how many credit cards you have reporting to your account, how old they are, how large the credit limits are. So if you don't even have that, it's difficult to, you know, rent an apartment because they check your credit score, get a cell phone. So the system itself, I mean, I think it's important to understand that the system itself is extremely complex, and we just can't assume that, you know, everybody has the time, the knowledge, and the ability to navigate that. So anyway, I would just say to Jim, it's not that quite that simple, unfortunately.
Listeners, if you agree or disagree, or if you want to share your stories about dealing with debt, maybe frustrations with consumer finance, or thoughts about maybe doing it differently, if you had the kind of coaching that Jason's talking about, or maybe you think about your parents or people in your life who have been struggling with debt, have they been misled? Would you like to see changes? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Human beings like what is simple, what is easy. And you think there's even an evolutionary component to that, Jason?
I do. So, you know, we evolved over, you know, millions of years, and we really evolved to operate within a pretty short time horizon, right? You couldn't store nuts, berries, and meats for that long, right? So everything was kind of consumed within a short time window, and people didn't live that long. And so we just didn't evolve to live, you know, 80, 90, even 100 years now in an unbelievably complex financial system. And what's remarkable about the U.S. financial system, it effectively co-evolved with the humans to extract as much value as possible from us as consumers and move it to the financial institutions. And the reason why banks have big buildings and there's lots of people who work there who have fancy suits, and it is because banks are really, really good at extracting value from us as consumers. And you know, going back to this idea of nudge and sludge, is they're really good at using all these little quirks in our brains to you know, effectively take value from us. And I think, you know, you pointed to one example with the credit card minimum payments. There's a whole host of examples of how banks are using complexity and, you know, kind of an unfair playing field to take as much value from us as possible.
Well, and one perfect example that came up in Michael Lewis's podcast when he was talking to Richard Thaler was 401k matches. So I think a lot of people would assume that if you have a job and your employer is willing to match a contribution to a 401k up to a certain point, that most people would say, yes, I will sign up for that. I will do whatever it takes to sign up and get that match. That's great. That's free money. Thaler points out that a lot of people don't even do that, that the match is there. People don't even take the free money. If you make it automatic that it's matched, well, then that's different. Then they get the match, they get the money, they say they're very happy with that. If you tell them, do you want it, they'll say yes, but they don't actually do the work to sign up for the match because that's an extra step of work. And again, the more cynical listeners might think, well, that's people's fault for being lazy. That's their fault for not taking that step. They're turning it down, and we shouldn't be designing things to be so easy that they have to do nothing. That's this, maybe the cynical view. How do you view it, Jason?
You know, I guess since I was talking to Professor Thaler yesterday, in using a couple examples of, I think, the beauty of design. So design in the human life is it should make it easy and seamless to, you know, not have stress and not be at risk. And if you use driving as an example, right? Your car, at least my car, if I don't put on my seatbelt, it dings at me, right? There's a backup camera, which makes it easier to not, you know, potentially back over one of my two children. When you're driving down the highway, it's really nice to have, you know, big signs that are easy to read, and like the rumble strips, if you kind of fall asleep, it kind of nudges you to wake up and, you know, not drive off the road. And so I think like, what makes humans so remarkable is we get to design our environment and design our world so that it doesn't require so much cognitive load to live our lives. And I just don't think there's anything, I guess, unreasonable about trying to make it easier on people. And I know, especially during the pandemic, I mean, my wife and I have two boys. It is exhausting trying to keep the wheels on this bus. And I don't know how it is for the listeners, but like anything at all that you can do to take things off my plate so I can focus on making sure my little kids are, you know, taken care of, getting an education. Hopefully I can take care of myself a little bit, exercise. You know, it's just like there's only so many brain cycles you have in the day. And the more kind of free value you can give to humans without really costing anybody, like, why wouldn't you want that? Why wouldn't that be a rational thing?
Yeah, and I think Keurig coffee makers is a good example of exactly the principle that you're talking about. When things are automatic for people, they're more likely to do it. So with Keurig, that is not good coffee. There's nothing special about the coffee. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's certainly nothing special. It's not good. Those pods are not good for the environment. But people love being able to just stick a pod in, press one button, and you have a cup of coffee. You don't have to grind the beans. You don't have to pour the water over it. So it's automatic almost. I mean, it's easier. So you get kind of a substandard or very average product, but it becomes a billion-dollar company because it's so easy, and people appreciate that. We've evolved to need that and to want that and to look for that. So when it comes to credit cards, that's a perfect example on your statement, as you guys talked about in the podcast with Michael Lewis. So I looked it up on my own, and the first thing I saw was exactly what you're talking about. The default payment for me is the minimum payment. Take me through all the little things that credit card companies do to make it easy to make bad decisions financially.
Yeah, well, the first thing is just how they actually design the credit card. So at its core, a credit card is really two products. So it's a payment product and it's a loan. And so if you look at all the advertising and everything, it's like, hey, be smart. This is, you know, the best way to pay for things. You get, you know, all these protections, you get points, rewards, and as you alluded to, you know, you can get a picture of your dog on some cards, and perhaps, you know, affinity, like you really like JetBlue or American Airlines, whatever it is, right? So all these things that kind of lull us into thinking, oh, cool, I'm making a good decision here. But then, you know, the only thing that you have to do in order to start accruing this, you know, ridiculously high interest rates is, you know, the statement comes, And they say, pay this minimum. And if you're in a situation where that month you don't have that much money in your checking account, and you're like, gee, like, you know, maybe I will pay less than the full amount. And that happens over a couple months and then eventually a couple of years, and you end up with all of this credit card debt. So that kind of psychology is really just designed to what's called the default, which is just you end up borrowing by default if you don't pay the full amount. And For Americans, the average American has 4 credit cards, and that means they have 48 due dates per year. And there are actually a shockingly low number of people who use auto pay. Only 16% of Americans use auto pay for their credit cards because the statement amount is different every single month on your card. So people like to have more control, so they go in and pay it manually. But that leads to $13 billion in late fees, because you can imagine 48 opportunities to forget once or twice to pay on time, and they whack you with a $35 late fee. So all of that stress and complexity managing all those cards is what TallyUp from using software does for you, so that you can get the benefits of cards, right? Because there certainly are benefits, but without the burden.
In our second half hour, we're going to talk exactly about how Tally works to try to do it differently. But to be blunt, Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally, Michael Lewis says we should stop thinking of finance as a business and start thinking of it as a competitive sport. And in this sport, the credit card companies are undefeated. He says they want you to make the minimum payment. They want you to pile up debt. They want you to spend a lot. And they want to be able to hit you with interest. You agree with that?
I love that metaphor. Michael Lewis said it better than I ever have.
All right. And he also put it in the context of coaching. I mean, that's the whole season of his podcast, which I think is actually, he did the refs in the first season. Now he's doing coaching, and he's got such a great eye for telling stories and understanding a narrative of what's going on in society. He says coaching itself is a source of unfairness, that the very, very top talent in the world, whether it's sports or chess or all kinds of things, art, they're already the best, and they get the best coaching. Most people who struggle have no coaching, and when it comes to finances, most of us either get no coaching or we get bad coaching. We get bad advice from the credit cards that we sign up for, and as a result, a lot of people who would be probably fine, maybe even owning a home, end up in real, real trouble. Is that how you feel when you think about your mother?
Yeah, I my mom in particular had no coaching, right? I mean, she didn't learn how to manage money or anything from her parents, and she really didn't have the opportunity to know what to do or how to do it, even though she was doing her best. I mean, she was very disciplined, all right. Obviously, envelopes and keeping track of every dime. So she was at least good at one part of her financial life, but in terms of hey, what about the future? Like, what about insurance? What if something goes wrong? What do you do when you can't work anymore? Like, those kind of things is just she didn't have any concept of how to handle that. And, what is complex about modern life is you basically have to share your money with three people. You've got your present self, you've got your past self, and your future self, right? So your past self might have racked up some card debt or student loans, and you got to pay for that. And then your future self is thinking, hey, at some point I'd maybe like to retire or buy a house. So you got to share your money there. And then your present self, likes to watch Netflix and go to good dinners and such. And so that's complex enough all by itself. And then to layer on top of that, the entire, financial system is trying to make it as difficult as possible to make the right decisions. It's like, That's if there's one place in your life where you need a coach, it's in your financial life. I just don't think there's much more complex in modern life than navigating your financial world.
My guest is Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally. Meet Tally.com, the website, trying to do consumer finance totally differently. And in our second half hour, we'll take some of your comments. We've got some emails to share. It's connections@wxxi.org. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. On the other side of our only break, so how does he do it? How does Tally decide to handle this very, very differently than we're all used to when it comes to finance? The answer next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we continue our series of conversations with local school superintendents about reopening schools, answering your questions about what it means for students, masking, testing, tracing, what happens in cases of infections, and more. Then in our second hour, summer jobs are way down this year. What does it mean for a future if the culture of the summer job goes away. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So as we've been talking about, credit card companies set you up to pay the minimum. They set you up for high interest rates. They make it enticing to spend with rewards and air miles and all kinds of things. They give you shiny cards. You can design the cards, pick your favorite color, put your dog's picture on there. They want you to spend, and they want you to pay the minimum. Jason Brown and Tally have a different view, and we said earlier as well that Richard Thaler once said that what we really need is a good bank, and we kind of joked that, well, that's what Tally really is. But what exactly is Tally, and let's talk about how it works, Jason.
All right. Well, we're a consumer tech company, and we're automating the way people manage their financial lives. So we started by tackling credit card debt because it's one of the most widespread financial issues in America. And, you know, listeners might be surprised to hear that there's nearly $1 trillion of card debt in the U.S. and about half of U.S. households have credit card debt. So what we're doing is we're really leveraging technology to do the financial thinking and work for people to get them out of debt faster, save them money, and give them peace of mind.
So how does it work here? If I want to go to Tally, what do I need to do, and what's that process like?
Yeah, so you just go to either the Google Android App Store or the Apple App Store. Type Tally, you'll see the app. You download it. You pass a soft credit check, so it doesn't affect your credit score at all. And then you enter your cards and connect the accounts. And then what Tally does is it actually manages your cards for you. So it pays all your cards for you at the right time, and it automatically saves you money on interest by moving over your high interest balances to Tally. And the main benefits with Tally is you have one place to see and manage all your cards. Tally guarantees you won't get any late fees. It's saving you money on interest. And then one of the coolest aspects is this is, you know, back to the nudge, getting you to do the good things, is we actually, instead of trying to get you to pay as little as possible, we're trying to get you to pay as much as possible. So we actually recommend, based on your income and your expenses, what you should pay each month, so that we can get you to, you know, effectively invest as much of the cash that you have available into yourself by paying down your debt as quickly as possible.
So you reward people for carrying less debt, essentially.
Correct.
Yeah.
If you have credit card debt, you know, there is besides maybe contributing to a matching 401k, because that's pre-tax dollars and free money. But aside from like a couple of very specific instances, if you have credit card debt, the single highest return you can get on your money, the best possible place you can put your money is to pay towards your cards. And even paying an extra $5, $10, $15 can save you thousands over time. So people don't realize that, just, you know, again, we're trying to nudge you to pay a little bit more so that you can, you know, obviously save money and get out of debt faster.
So no late fees, because everything happens through Tally. So let me just give you a hypothetical example. The average American with four cards and $15,000 of debt. Let's say there's an American, two cards, $15,000 of debt. One card's got $12,000. The other card's got $3,000, and we're going to consolidate that. We're going to use Tally, so everything's in front of us in one place here. No late fees, because Tally is making that payment on a monthly basis. Is that right?
That's correct. So yeah, when you add your two cards, so Tally would analyze the card, and let's just for simplicity say that, complexity, but let's say the $3,000 balance one is on 0% APR promotion for like a year.
Okay.
So Tally would recognize that and say, oh, actually, we actually don't want to move that balance over to Tally, because zero APR is a good thing for you. So when you sign up, let's say Tally moves over the $12,000 to Tally, you know, let's say from a 20% APR to a 9 or 10% APR, and then Tally is now watching your cards every day and managing them, and it is actually paying them exactly when they're due. So that's why you don't have to worry about the late fees. And then when, you know, it's the time of the month of, hey, Tally would say, hey, Evan, you know, I recommend you pay, you know, let's say $400, because we're looking at what you have in your checking account and your expenses, whereas maybe the minimum would only be like $100. So we're trying to get you to pay four times the minimum, in addition to having obviously saved you quite a lot of money on interest, because instead of paying that 20 or paying, you know, maybe 9 or 10, So we're giving you effectively free money and savings, and then also trying to get you to pay as much as possible so you can get that that debt knocked out.
Now let's pretend I'm a veteran from the credit card industry, and I hear about your plan, and I call you up and I say, listen, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have Americans who are going to bring their credit card debt to Tally. Tally will be doing the diligent work of paying the credit card companies. You're going to ask them to pay you. They're going to fall behind. They're not going to pay you. You're going to be in the same position that the credit card companies are in, but somehow you've got to come up with more interest because you've got them paying less in interest, or Tally's paying, I don't know how Tally's paying less in interest. How are you making any money in this? How is this not going to fall apart?
Well, here's the shocking thing about credit card interest is that APRs are just unbelievably high for no reason other than the cards can get away with it. What we're doing is we're actually simply going to banks, borrowing in bulk on behalf of all of our customers at much lower rates and passing those savings on to our customers. So with Tally, we are only making money if we're actually saving people money on interest by getting them a lower rate. So we're really actually just using the financial system actually to benefit consumers rather than to harm consumers.
Okay, so the leverage of volume, and do you have people who are hanging with it, who are paying you when they need to pay you? What happens if you've got a lot of customers who can't do that and all of a sudden things start to fall apart?
Well, the thing is we're in order to get approved to use Tally, you do have to have certain credit attributes. So, for example, you have to have a 660 FICO. So we're first off, working with people who we think that have the ability to pay and touch. Secondly, take somebody who runs into a hard time, maybe they lose their job. Our team will reach out to them right away and say, hey, it looks like, maybe you're having a little trouble. What can we do to work with you? And as long as customers are willing to work with us and come up with a plan, we're there to support them. So the only instance where, we would have to, basically like close their account and all that is somebody who stops paying Tally and doesn't work with us. So at the end of the day, we're incentivized to help them be less stressed and better off financially, regardless of the situation.
Talking to Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally. So let's sort through some of what listeners want to know. Sarah wants to know, why is any of this legal? I don't think she's talking about what you're doing. I think what she's talking about is what the credit card companies are doing. Michael Lewis said on his podcast that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau seems to be at times the only one who can step in to help, and often they don't, at least not lately. Is that what you've observed?
Yeah, 100%. Let me give an example pre-financial crisis, so pre-2009. So there was a practice that the credit card companies would do, which is this, which is they would see that you have a bunch of balance on your credit card, and then they would send you an offer to say you could do a $3,000 balance transfer at 0% APR. And you're like, oh, that's cool. So you do it. What they do, though, is they would order your payment so that any new payments you send pay off the 0% APR first. So it's almost like this lid that traps like the 30% APR debt. So you can't actually even pay it off. You can't get to it until you pay through the 0% APR. And so the regulators came in, the CFPB in particular, there's something called the CARD Act, which said, hey, it's actually legal. You have to apply a customer's payment to the highest APR first in their account. And so That was one small thing, but get this. So a lot of people are surprised. Every APR, usually it's like, let's say it's 20.99, for example. All APRs are actually 29.9949. So every APR actually has the third and fourth digit after the decimal, because you're actually allowed to do that with a law, as long as it doesn't round up. So there's like all these little things that banks will literally exploit to the thousandth of a percent if it's legal. And from my perspective, I think the CFPB could do more to protect people. But that's unfortunately the way it is in this country.
Well, Sarah's asking why it's legal at all for credit cards to set up a system this way that leads to $1 trillion in card debt, more than $1 trillion in student loan debt. Is there anything in terms of policy that you think ought to be done that would change this?
Yeah, well, I mean, to answer why is it that way is because it's really freaking profitable and banks make a lot of money and do a lot of lobbying. So that's the reason the way it is. I think from a policy standpoint, I'm a big fan of the CFPB, and our actual VP of legal was at the CFPB for the first 5 years of its founding. And in those first years, it did a lot of good. They did a lot of enforcement. And what I think maybe listeners might not understand is just because something on the books, let's say the law says it's not allowed, you know, banks will still do it if they don't think the law will be enforced. And so the CFPB was supposed to enforce the law that was on the books. And things were going well. And then, you know, unfortunately, the current administration has effectively defunded the CFPB. And now it doesn't have the ability, the resource, or the motivation to go out and literally just simply enforce the laws that are already on the books. So I think a simple policy change would be to obviously be able to better fund the CFPB. There's another one which is less obvious, and I know you have a very well-educated audience, so I'll throw this one out there. It's a little nerdy, but banks and financial institutions think that they own your data. So they think that all of your transaction data and such, Evan, it's not yours, it's the bank's. When the law actually suggests it's actually Evan's data. And so the Congress actually has the ability to mandate that the banks give you access to all of your data real time in a machine readable format. Now that seems kind of esoteric. You're like, why are you talking about that, Jason? But here's the thing is if you make all of your data Evan's data and you can control who gets access to it and when, and it's in a standardized format, you can actually very easily, effectively, like move your accounts from one institution to the next. And what that causes is the cost of all those financial services to go down. And the example of when the government did that is actually the cell phone industry. So in early 2000, right before 2000, if you wanted to switch providers from, let's say, T-Mobile to Verizon, you actually had to give up your phone number. So you couldn't take your phone number from one carrier to the next. And the carriers loved that because it made it much less likely that Evan would switch carriers, which means they could charge you a lot more because they know you're not going to leave. The government came in and said, actually, legally, you have to allow people to port their number. They have to be able to carry their number with them. And there's a professor from Berkeley who did some research right after that law went into effect and showed that immediately cell phone plans dropped by between 5% and 20% per month in terms of cost that the carriers were charging. So anytime you give more power to consumers, it's good for consumers. And I think policies like that at a minimum are a good place to start.
And I want to underscore one other point before I get to more listener emails on CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Because I only know a little bit, and I probably know enough to be dangerous, and I want to make sure I've got the story straight here on this, Jason. So, one of the places I started hearing more about this was Michael Lewis's first season of his podcast, and the question came up, well, why is it that refs aren't blowing the whistle more on this stuff? Whether it's the kinds of predatory loans that we've been talking about, the setups that seem to designed to get people to sign up for loans without knowing just how serious it is, even the ostensible helplines, which are designed to get people off the phone in 7 minutes or less. And Michael Lewis is doing this podcast on this, and he's saying, didn't anybody know about this? How come nobody knew about this? And he says, well, in 2008, one person knew about this. And if it was Senator Elizabeth Warren, and she had been warning about this and these kinds of scams and schemes when it comes to predatory lending. And she seemed to have a pretty serious hand in the creation of CFPB, and that for a while it was doing its job. But in the Trump administration, it has been largely gutted and defanged. Is that a fair narrative? Is that oversimplified?
Yes, it is oversimplified, but I would say it's very fair. And what I find frustrating is that it's this somehow political issue, right? I think there's a Netflix documentary called Dirty Money, and it goes into one of the enforcements around some payday loan practices were just appalling. And I just don't know why it's a political issue that we enforce the laws that are on the books that protect consumers. I think we could debate all day long. I think there should be new laws and they could be better, but at a minimum, let's protect consumers based on what we've already voted into law. And I just can't understand why. Well, I understand why it's a political issue, because lobbyists have, you know, leveraged this very politicized system that we're in right now to make it seem like it's somehow patriotic to not enforce these rules that protect consumers. But I just think it's really sad, because the CFPB is just there to make sure, you know, consumers are not being taken advantage of.
All right. So let me just rip through some listener feedback here, and we'll get through as much as we can. This is from Megan, who says, I'd like to comment on the theory that if you don't want anxiety from credit, don't get credit. If you don't have any credit, you can't get a mortgage to buy a home. My husband and I were newly married and looking to purchase our first home, but when we applied for the mortgage, we were denied. My credit was excellent, but my husband had no credit, and therefore we had to get a co-signer to get the mortgage and almost lost the opportunity to purchase a home. The system is designed to force you to have credit in order to make purchases. That's from Megan. Jason's thoughts there?
Well said. I can't do better than that.
Donald says, listening to your show and have to comment about Amazon. They are masters at getting value out of consumers. A purchase at Amazon is as quick as I want it. They have it. I just have to click here. They know the shipping information, the billing information, everything. It's horribly easy to spend hundreds of dollars or more every month without ever realizing it, without opening your wallet, and without even swiping a single card. That's from Donald. He's right about that with Amazon. But Jason, is that a problem?
I mean, it's a problem for me. I have you ever, I mean, I've like one time there's, you know, a Amazon box showed up and I'm like, what's that? I didn't order anything. I opened it. I'm like, huh? And I had to literally go look. I'm like, oh yeah, I did order that. It's like, it's amazing how, you know, at least me personally, I can be kind of in zombie mode and just be like, oh yeah, I want that. And it's just almost like it just skips the part of your brain that's supposed to be keeping an eye on things. So I know that something that I struggle with as well.
Paul writes to say, Evan, the Tally Show is kind of straddling the boundary between being news versus marketing promotion for a specific company. Seems a bit of both, and your guest has a product to sell. Locally, consumer credit counseling services is another option. That's from Paul in Webster. Paul, let me just say, you know, I reached out to Jason and Tally because I was deeply moved by Michael Lewis's podcast and the conversation he had with Jason. And of course, Jason is the co-founder and CEO of Tally. You know, he's got a living that he's trying to make here. And that's why I joked at the beginning. If he turns out to be a scam artist, then I will have been the biggest mark of all time, and I will feel really disappointed in him and for listeners. But sometimes something seems so unusual that I think it is worth spotlighting. I'm not telling you to go use Tally. You can decide that if you want to or not. I am remarking about a system in which the vast majority of consumer finance is exactly the opposite of what Jason is trying to do here. And we have seen people in our own lives who have been impacted by this, and there's probably a lot of listeners too. So I will just say, you can make any decision you want, but Jason, I will ask you, who are your biggest competitors trying to do it the right way?
Well, our biggest competitor is just the credit card itself, because, you know, people don't wake up. There's not one moment where it's, let's say, on, you know, September 4th, you wake up and you're like, this is the time where I got to solve this problem, right? You just have all these minimum payments and people just kind of going through. And one of the most common behaviors actually is kind of sweeping it under the rug. So it's so anxiety inducing that people just don't want to think about it. And so they just kind of, you know, muddle through year after year without addressing the problem. So we built the first and only automated credit card manager. And in most cases, the competition is people just doing nothing. So I would agree. I would say any way that people want to tackle their credit card is a good thing. Anything that motivates you to pay down debt, whether it's Tally or your grandmother or credit counseling, I'm a fan of all of it. Tally just uses math and software to make it easier.
Yeah, and listeners, you notice I didn't even get to how Tally works until the second half hour. I mean, really, this program is about a system that is designed to put people in very bad shape while benefiting one specific industry, and that's the credit card industry generally. How much does it cost to use Tally, Jason?
Yeah, so it's free to download Tally, and the way Tally makes money is actually by saving money. So the only time we can make money is when we're actually saving you money on interest. And we're actually experimenting and innovating our product offering to be able to support and help more people. So some of those new features will be free, and some of them will probably charge a monthly subscription. But the core offering of Tally is free to use, and we only make money if we're saving you money on interest or protecting you from late fees.
Different Jim emails to say it's criminal that credit cards usually provided by banks charge double-digit interest on a balance, while the same bank gives only maybe 1% interest for money in a savings account. Why is my money not worth as much as theirs? That's from Jim. What would you say to that, Jason?
I mean, that literally is the unfairness of the system. So especially in current times, banks are borrowing at almost zero, if not zero. That's literally a fact. And APRs are, you know, still in the high teens, low 20s. Credit cards are the single most profitable bank product. And that's why banks are so incentivized to keep the current system in place.
Listeners, check if you can to see if your default payment option on your credit cards is the minimum. That's what it was for me. And I find it's interesting. You hardly ever even think about this. But when you think about it in these terms and you realize how much debt we have, you start to see why. Jason Brown, the co-founder and CEO of Tally, meettally.com. You want to learn more. Thanks for talking about these issues and for spending the hour with us. And I appreciate your story and what you're doing. Thanks for being with us, Jason.
Thanks, Evan.
Great stuff there. And I certainly learned a lot myself. Listeners, I hope you did too. Have a nice afternoon here. And from the whole team at Connections, Rob Braden's the engineer, Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And we will talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.